From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
It becomes harder and harder to do the kinds of stories that the press was doing back in the 1970s. I was with the Associated Press during this period.
That was the voice of the late award-winning journalist Robert Parry, the founder of ConsortiumNews.com, best known for his role in covering the Iran-Contra affair for the Associated Press and Newsweek, and the scandal involving the CIA and Contras trafficking cocaine in the U.S., which broke in 1985. These clips from an interview in 2010 present what was pretty much Parry's stock discussion of the history of journalism in the U.S. beginning in the late 1960s, which he saw up close and personal. Here he describes some of his own experiences at the Associated Press.
I was on the special assignment team, and in trying to dig into some of these stories became something that was more and more of a career risk. And a lot of journalists who tried to do these stories ended up having very bad outcomes. One of the famous cases dealt with Raymond Bonner, who was a New York Times correspondent in Central America. And he was describing these death squad activities that were underway by right-wing government supported by the Reagan administration. And that wasn't acceptable to the Reagan people. So they began to attack him. They had their outside groups try to question his ethics and his, you know, the quality of his journalism. And when he did a major piece about a massacre that had occurred in 1981 at a place called El Mazote, and he exposed this in early 82, just as Reagan was putting out a report saying that the Salvadoran military was now acting in respect of human rights, that was very embarrassing for the Reagan people. So they went after Ray Bonner even more. And ultimately, the New York Times, which had an executive editor, Abe Rosenthal, who was also sympathetic to the neoconservative cause, basically Bonner was pulled out, given a humiliating assignment, and ultimately forced out of the New York Times. And that kind of message was being sent to all of us, that if you really cared about your career, you don't go to certain places. You don't write certain stories.
Robert Parry passed away this past January 27th. But not before creating an alternative to the restrictive corporate media that he refers to here. That alternative, his legacy, ConsortiumNews.com, now has journalist Joe Loria at the helm, and we spoke with him via Skype from Washington, D.C., Tuesday.
It was a complete shock when Bob died on 27 January. But I have a lot of thanking the board of the Consortium for Independent Journalism that appointed me as editor-in-chief, and I'm not even going to try to fill his shoes, as people have been saying. It's impossible to do that. I'm going to do whatever I can to, the best way I can, to keep his legacy alive, which was principled and nonpartisan journalism, and to expand coverage. I got several ideas, so I want to build up the site more to get more readers, but it's never going to touch the core of what Bob Parry created, and that's because I happen to agree with what Bob created, both what he wrote and the principles he stood for.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I don't think there's, I really can't think of who else I might say this about to you particularly, but yeah, those are some pretty big shoes to fill. He did an awful lot of stuff, and you are no slouch, which is why I prefaced it that way. You're somebody that I've been following for a very long time, looking at foreign affairs when you were at the UN, I've been a fan, quote unquote, and a consumer and someone being educated by you more or less for most of my adult life. So, and yet I'm looking at, geez, if I were you, looking at Robert's shoes, yeah, those are some big shoes to fill, aren't they?
I feel, well, thank you for that, Don. I had no idea that you were lurking in the background reading
my
stuff.
Exactly. Yeah, right. That was me.
But I feel a little like Babe Daldrin. Do you know who that is?
No, who's that?
Does anybody in your audience know? No, I don't think
so. I don't see any hands.
He's the guy who took over at first base for Lou Gehrig.
Ah, I hear you.
And I hope decades from now I'm not as forgotten as Babe Daldrin is, but certainly no one's going to forget Bob Parry as no one has forgotten Lou Gehrig. So, yeah. No, it is something. Look, Bob, as I said in my talk, and there were some really good speeches at the memorial on Saturday at the Pentagon City Sheraton Hotel here in Northern Virginia. Bob was the only editor who ever understood what I was writing about and accepted it. I spoke at length about how he started Consortium News, and it was essentially because he got fed up with his editors at AP and then Newsweek killing stories of great national significance related to the Iran-Contra scandal. They would edit the thing out, take out any reference to the CIA. They spiked stories. They kept delaying that. It was clear what they were doing. One story he's often told that I repeated was that he went to a dinner in Washington where Brent Scowcroft, who was the current, at the time, National Security Advisor, was present. And well, it came up about one of these stories, and Bob's editor came over to him from Newsweek and told him that they had to suppress the story for the good of the country. Mm. And as I pointed out, they were really talking about for the good of the rulers of the country, not for the rest of
right.
us. And so he started, he got fed up and started Consortium News with his two sons, Nat and Sam. And the idea behind it was to create a consortium for other journalists in the mainstream who kept getting their stories suppressed, could not get them published. And so he provided a place where these articles could be published that were being rejected mainly for political reasons. He did it in 1995. That was an era where people were doing dial-up modems for AOL and CompuServe. So it was one of the earliest, and it might be the very first, news or investigative news website ever created. It was Bob had actually not even heard of the internet. It was his son Sam who told him about this thing.
Yep.
And, well, it's been around for 22 years now, 23 years, and he built it up into something extraordinary. It did not get the attention and reach that I think he and others wanted, but it was a serious website. It is one that was read here in Washington by powerful people. I've been told just recently that his articles go to the office of the president of Russia, and also Trump has been shown articles. So while it doesn't have the reach that we'd want, and I'm hoping to expand that by bringing in new writers and covering new topics, it does have some kind of influence here in Washington. So that was because Bob was the whole show.
Yeah.
And that is one of the other difficult things about taking over. He did everything. He raised funds. He moderated the comments. He wrote a piece almost every day, and he edited three or four stories. I don't know how the man did it. I will not be able to work at that pace with that energy. I'm just getting started. I ask for patience. I'm ramping this thing up. They're going to be I brought in three or four new writers already, people like Margaret Kimberly of Black Agenda Report. I was very happy to have her in there. And I want to cover like labor issues. Labor used to be something that every metropolitan newspaper had one or two reporters covering, and now it doesn't exist. Right. And issues about women and struggle in the developing countries. I want to write maybe about climate. And we'd love to start an investigative unit in Bob's memory to actually have a couple of reporters dig deep and try to come up with some exclusives. So these are all things dependent on money. We're almost 100% funded by readers. So that's going to be all dependent on how much we could raise. But we got some plans. I don't know whether we're going to be able to do them or not, but I'm hoping to carry the core was foreign policy of the United States and being critical of the U.S. foreign policy. You know, in that speech, Don, I also mentioned how I became a 16 years after he started that in 95, one of those journalists that Bob created this for, that I learned through some bad experiences that my articles were also being spiked or complained about. For example, I covered the lead up to the 2003 invasion of Iraq at the UN, at the UN Security Council, at that time for a Canadian chain that was called Southern News then, and they published the Montreal Gazette, the Ottawa Citizen, Calgary Herald, and about 20 other papers. And I was covering the Security Council deliberations, and I was giving equal weight in my stories to what the German, the French, and the Russian delegations at the Security Council were saying. They were opposing the invasion. So I got a call from the foreign editor of this Southern News chain, and he started berating me. He called me from Ottawa. He berated me for not supporting the war effort. And he told me his son was a Marine, Canadian Marine.
Jesus.
I said, well, I'm sure you're very proud about your son, but my job is not to support the war, but to report what's going on at the Security Council, and they are opposing this resolution. Of course, the Bush administration never got that resolution, but they invaded anyway.
Right.
And it was illegal, as Kofi Annan, the then Secretary General, finally admitted in an interview with the BBC after being pressured by the the interviewer, he admitted it was illegal, and then he got hounded into a near nervous breakdown by the likes of then UN Ambassador John Bolton,
wow,
who has unfortunately gotten a promotion since then. I, on the other hand, was on the day of the invasion, 2003, was fired by
no kidding
in chain. Yes,
wow. I remember that day too. Jeez, I don't not your firing, but that day. Yeah, you know, I've been looking at this, like the entire landscape now with everything around around Trump, around Washington, around the U.S. and Russia, all of this, and watching it develop for a couple years, and I watch the public narrative, and I don't mean just the nonsense that's on TV and in the newspaper, but what people actually say, like at work, at the virtual water cooler now, whatever, in the supermarket, what they know. And, I'm amazed that because I'm reading foreign media and talking to people, in different places about this stuff. And so I know what people think, a good representation of what people think around the world. And I'm shocked that most people don't. And I'm looking at the talk that you gave, the eulogy that you gave for Robert, to the part where you said when you were doing this for the Montreal Gazette and those papers, that you gave equal weight to your stories to German, French, and Russian opposition on the Security Council. In other words, like, I listen to the whole Security Council meetings so I can hear, and I always like to hear what Bolivia says, for example.
Yeah.
They really lay out a lot of facts and a pretty good critique of the U.S. actions. But each one, they lay out some facts and they give you a perspective that's not the one being sold here. And, I'm reading what you wrote. It's clear to me it's not just an error of omission, but one of commission. It is affirmatively blocked out of the media here what other people are saying outside of their narrative.
That starts right at the source, at the Security Council, at the UN, when Western, and I saw this for 25 years as a UN correspondent, the Western correspondents close to Western ambassadors, the British, the French, and the Americans, they parrot what they're told. And there's an entire atmosphere that's built up over months and years that Syria, whatever the Syrian or the Russian or the Bolivian delegation says, is absolutely not to be taken seriously, that these people are off the wall, that they have a problem, they're jealous of the West, of the power, they're just ridiculed, they're not taken seriously, and the reporters who are vain and who are more interested in living through the power of politicians and diplomats vicariously to their power than exercising the power that the press has, which is distinct from governments, which is to hold government to account, to be a filter between what government says, and they all lie in government, all governments lie,
right.
People in governments lie. So the press, there's another party involved here, two parties, the press and the public. And the press is supposed to be the filter between what governments say and what the public receives, and to hold them to account, to challenge them, and then to, best as you can, to present what the facts are and what closest to the truth as possible to the public. But the press has absolutely abdicated that responsibility. They've given up that power. They are careerists, and they're vain, and they're living through the power of government, and they want to get close to them. It's not just about access. It's a mentality that's the same. And therefore, we don't have a real functioning press in general anymore. And that's what Bob Perry created with Consortium News, and why I'm so thrilled to be able to try to carry on his work, because I saw that every single day at the UN. I saw it at the Wall Street Journal. And it was at that speech on Monday that I first publicly revealed that. And I will tell you now that there were several stories at the journal that either spiked or suppressed before publishing or changed after publication. For example, the Defense Intelligence Agency document declassified that said the U.S., Turkey, and the U.S. Gulf allies were supporting Salafists in eastern Syria to put pressure on President Assad, and that it warned that those guys could turn into an Islamic State by aligning with similar jihadists in Iraq. It even used that term, Islamic State, and that is in August 2012, 2 years before the Islamic State was actually born. I pitched that story twice to the Wall Street Journal. It was twice rejected. I've seen it nowhere else in corporate media. That would undermine completely the American narrative on the war on terror. And then I pitched a, I wrote a couple of stories leading up to the vote on the Palestinian observer state status back in 2011 on at the UN General Assembly. And I kept mentioning in the story, which I thought was an extremely relevant fact, that 130 countries already recognized Palestine and some had exchanged ambassadors. That kept being taken out of my stories in the lead up to this vote. And of course, Palestine eventually got like 170 votes. It was only in that day that they of the story that they allowed me to publish that information. So these, I realized then, of course, the journal had an agenda, as most of corporate media does. And that agenda is not to be neutral in covering international affairs, to look at the clash of different nations in complex situations and to describe what their interests are, what motivates countries, but to promote American interests abroad. That is what the corporate media does. That is not journalism. That's something very, very different than that. So that's when I turned to Bob. It was after that Palestinian story that I turned to him. He didn't know me from a hole in the wall. I sent him my article on this. He published it. And then for 6 years, I published many stories on Consortium News, and he was the guy who gave a home to me and to other journalists. And then, of course, former intelligence agents like Ray McGovern, Phil Giraldi, right, and Paul Pilar published regularly at Consortium, and activists and other people started to publish there as well. But it was created for other journalists to publish work that was being suppressed. And that thing has gotten worse, as you're saying, I think, Don.
Yeah.
It's gotten worse to control than even years ago, even when Bob was first ran up to the up against those obstacles back in the 1980s.
Well, I mean, maybe you can, because you were at the UN all that time, so maybe you can tell me about how it was. But even now, if you look at the, you know, the basically the you know, the server of for UN Media, unmultimedia.org, you have the audiovisual library where you can do a direct download of a file, including an entire Security Council meeting, if it's put up there. And then you have live from UN webcast where everything that is recorded gets stored, but you can't do a direct download from there. For example, if there's a Security Council meeting, say, that doesn't go well for the United States, or that the United States doesn't want people to be readily access, say, the Syrian ambassador's comments or Russia's ambassador's comments, it'll be at the webcast, and the only way you can get that is to play it real time. So a 3-hour Security Council meeting, for me to capture it, I have to play it back. It takes 3 hours to record it off the clip. The things that go into the audiovisual library, you can just do a direct download, takes 30 seconds of that meeting. You can tell that somebody is saying, nope, not this one, nope, not that one. That's at the head end of what goes to the press.
Look, there have been instances where Bashar al-Jafri, the Syrian ambassador to the UN, his microphone was cut on UN broadcasts at the General Assembly. It's happened, I think, more than once. Mm-mm-mm. Questions were raised about that. You never get a straight answer. They say it's a technical problem. You never know whether that's true or not, but it's very suspicious. I mean, that's just one small part, Don, of how the big powers, and since the end of the Cold War, the United States almost exclusively, pressures the UN to follow its line. And I actually have a big book proposal on the history of the of that relationship between the UN and the big powers, the United States, particularly with the Soviet Union during the Cold War, and each Secretary General, how they stood up to the United States. And we only really see Dag Hammarskjöld as the only one who stood up to both the Soviets and the Americans. And maybe he lost his life because of that.
Yeah.
So this is a crisis at the UN, and that's a part of it. I mean, those kind of mechanicians at the multimedia center there, what I don't know exactly what's going on. I can't tell you, but it does look very suspicious. And but it's part of, it would fit right into the idea of silencing or marginalizing what these guys say, what the Russians say, the Bolivians, the Chinese, the Syrian ambassador. It doesn't get play in the Western media. These voices of the Iranians and the North Koreans and the Syrians and the Palestinians, they are either suppressed completely or marginalized to the point where you dehumanize people in those countries. And that makes it easier to go to war against those countries, to get U.S. public support, when you don't know, the American people don't know what these people think, what they say, what their point of view is, what their interests are. Instead, there's this cartoonish presentation of American foreign policy as being somehow moral, rather than it just following its interests, mostly violently, as all great powers do. That's what the United States is. It's following its interests abroad. That's what big, powerful countries have done in history, what empires have done in history. But we are somehow made to believe by supposedly serious journalism like the New York Times and others that the United States has a moral equation in what they do. Just take the airstrikes against Syria, which was, we don't even know if there was a chemical attack the other day. And the United States was not threatened in any way by that. It was not under Article 51 of the UN Charter of Self-Defense.
Right.
Security Council certainly didn't authorize it. It's illegal. Right. Under international law and under U.S. law, since Congress never authorized that. So they keep peddling this story that America did it to save the people's lives from chemical attacks. And it's a moral – I mean, it's absolute rubbish. And I think more and more people are not buying it. But the American mainstream media keeps pushing this line. They give a platform to those guys at the Pentagon saying that or to Trump saying that instead of challenging that. And very easily doing that by giving some historical perspective of this war in Syria and certainly of American post-war behavior that has not been very moral. But we don't get those stories. That's all left out, unfortunately. And that's the sin of omission, I think, is the greatest sin of the corporate media.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that they could stop omitting would be at the bottom of the screen, as whenever they run a news piece about any of these things, just run the body count, at the hands of the U.S. since 1945. Okay, I mean, I realize it'll look like that stupid, deficit clock that they've had
exactly.
In New York.
It wouldn't fit. It wouldn't fit under the screen.
You need an HD screen. So it's wide enough. Yeah.
You need a 50-inch TV easily to be able to read that.
It's interesting that you said the public narrative that's been peddled by the media has been so decoupled from reality for so long that there's actually a huge vector that's almost impossible to recapture because it is just disorient too many people. But I thought all those things were true. Now this is true, kind of a thing. And I'm looking at what just happened in Syria and wondering if we're not seeing that kind of play out. Like, I was trying to figure out what exactly is the real purpose behind what Trump just did. I understand how he's getting forced into some things, and there's also a push, what's-her-face, off the front page thing that went on. It goes back to at least Bill Clinton bombing Iraq right. Every time they went to impeach him or whatever. But I'm thinking about the fact that they decided to say, we found chemical weapons factories. We have not. I mean, no one has said we've proven that they belong to the state and this was the source of those things. It's assumed that, but no one's actually holding, they've been pretty deliberate about leaving that a little mushy. And I'm wondering if what they're going to end up doing is just saying, look, the Russians got rid of 90% of it. We blew up the rest of it. We can say with confidence the government doesn't have those weapons. So if there's another use of them, they can flip the narrative, and it will make sense to the people that have been following the public narrative. In other words, I don't know if I'm making it clear, but basically my point is that the public narrative has been so decoupled from reality that I'm wondering if some effort isn't being made, or in any event, doesn't some effort need to be made to try to reconcile the illusion that people have of reality with some, becoming awareness of reality.
Yeah, consortiumnews.com.
Right, okay.
Well, that's what we're trying to do here by completely bypassing the corporate media and going to facts such as the 100% of the Syrian chemicals that were banned on the OPCW banned list,
right.
Organization for Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, 100% were removed from Syria, were destroyed on a U.S. naval vessel in the Atlantic Ocean, was certified by John Kerry, then Secretary of State, by the UN Security Council, and by the OPCW itself. They had destroyed those chemicals. Chlorine, which is believed to have been used in this latest attack in Douma, the suburb of Damascus, is not on the OPCW banned list. Every country in the world is allowed to possess it. You're not allowed to use it as a weapon. but you're allowed to have it. So when you get Christiane Amanpour saying on the night of the attack, right after the bombs started falling, that the Allies had no choice because they have chlorine and they have still chemical weapons that were banned, she's completely wrong about that and not corrected. So they actually, either knowingly or unknowingly, and it could be just ignorance there, because she was pushing this idea, as so many pundits did, as the generals who were wheeled out onto CNN and others who have contracts with arms manufacturers that they never disclose, are cheerleading for war. They're talking about the equipment that's being used, the very equipment these guys are going to peddle. It is so damn obvious. And they leave out the questionable facts of this, the fact that Mattis, James Mattis, the defense secretary, the day before had said, we don't have evidence on Capitol Hill. He went to the White House to try to get a delay on this until there was evidence that there ever was even a chemical weapons attack. And the next day he was out there saying he had the evidence, but he wouldn't say what it was. They don't have the evidence. The guys who worked in some of those buildings that were destroyed said they were making antidotes to snake venom. There were no chemicals released anywhere. I think this was an effort by the United States to show they're still relevant in Syria. They are losing the war there, but they don't want to let it let Syria stabilize. They need to stay there and screw things up. And now, ominously, they are asking, and the Saudis today offered troops to go to eastern Syria to augment or replace with the United States contingent there. So it looks like that plan to divide Syria, or at least take that eastern part, is coming to be. And U.S. needed to show off by blowing up some bombs again. They're not to be dismissed or taken lightly. And it wasn't a thumb in, you know, to slap in the face to Vladimir Putin. It was an attempt by Trump to show that he was tough on Russia, and yes, to get that porn star off the front pages, etc. So it's a disgusting display that we saw. Fortunately, nobody was killed, apparently, but it was just what we've seen before from the United States, and unfortunately what we will see again. And it's the media that we're focusing on in this conversation, that I'm focusing on, because we need alternative media to step up, and Consortium is one of them that's going to run stories, and we have a whole bunch on Syria in the last 2 days that I've published, and I got two or three more today that I'm going to run, that are challenging this dominant narrative that's based on misinformation, ignorance, or outright lies.
Yep. So as you grapple with taking over the reins there, what are some of the challenges that you see, other than the looming figure of Bob?
Learning how to use WordPress. Absolute challenge. It's a really, they have a free model and a designer model. You need to know code to do some things, and I don't. So we may be moving to a different system, so I can work with the layout very soon. What I'm saying, I'm half joking, but I am saying there are practical issues here in learning how the system works. Moderating comments. Comments is a huge headache, I think, for any website. We have a system that automatically pulls out some comments and needs to be then manually checked. Some of them are perfectly fine. We have no idea why they're being pulled out. And then people are getting upset that their comments have not appeared for several hours. Those, apart from those practical matters, getting new writers in, to bring new voices in, to expand our coverage into different issues, race relations, women, labor, as I said, and other political domestic issues, without touching the core of criticism of American foreign policy, which is my background, which is what Bob wrote mostly about. It's not just going to be Russiagate, 100% of the time. We're going to continue to stay on that story and continue to be skeptical of that. Consortium News made its, and Bob made his mark again by being highly skeptical of the stories of Russia's interference in the election without any strong evidence being made. So we're going to continue to run stories like that. And once I get things up and running and all systems go, I'm going to try to start writing more myself. I will never replace the piece in quantity or quality that Bob wrote, but I'm going to contribute, my 2 cents on as often as possible. I think it's going to be recognizable as the Consortium News that Bob, but very different in a lot of ways, because of a lot of new writers and topics that we're covering, but also because of the absence of Bob's stories, a hole that will never obviously be filled.
Joe, thank you very much. And we'll be following you for sure, and hopefully speaking with you again real soon. Best of luck in this new endeavor.
Well, thank you, Don. It's great chatting with you.
Same. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.